a period of about 10 years. That's going to have to be negotiated once again with the Republican Senate. So whether he gets to go that far, it remains to be seen. But that is going to be the new emphasis coming out of the White House.
And finally, how do you think the U.S. is going to be able to offset China's economic influence globally and its penetration into U.S. markets when China is already ahead in its post-COVID-19 period, all the numbers say so, while the U.S. is still grappling with the COVID-19?
There are two different questions in there. First of all, this is something Biden can do pretty much on his own. We've seen Trump alienate our international colleagues, literally lock out of any kind of negotiations countries like Iran or China. And Biden is not of that ilk. Biden wants to work with our international colleagues. He wants to open up relations and communications with countries like Iran and China. And so we're going to see a big change. And Biden can do that on his own as the executive. He doesn't need congressional approval on a lot of this. So we are going to see changes there.
Okay. Thank you very much for that. That's Craig Holman, Public Citizens Capitol Hill lobbyist, with his statements there. Obviously very pro Biden. Again, once Biden gets elected, or confirmed, I should say. Well, it's time for a quick break here on Economic Divide, but don't go anywhere. We have plenty more coming up in the next half of the program. Welcome back to Economic Divide with Mika Vitale. In this in-depth section, we are going to put the current Treasury Secretary, Steven Mnuchin, under the spotlight. Why? Well, it first started with this headline. Paul Krugman, the famous economist, slammed the Trump administration plot to sabotage the economy and hurt Biden. The article said that, unfortunately, a decision made by Mnuchin, according to the New York Times, won't make it any easier for Biden to handle the economy. Well, let's go to the source, the New York Times. Now, this is what the headline stated, Mnuchin's inglorious endgame. And the New York Times couldn't be more blunt than this. Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin is spending his last few months in office trying to undermine President-elect Joe Biden and the American economy. How is Mnuchin going about this? Well, the Trump administration is reportedly abruptly curtailing the Federal Reserve's emergency lending programs. These are safety net programs that Americans rely on during these desperate times. Here is what Paul McCulley, former PIMCO chief, economist, and senior fellow at Cornell University, said about the Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin's decision in his appearance on CNBC.
You said you don't buy the fact that there wasn't a political flavor here. What do you mean by that, Paul? You think this was a deliberate attempt to sabotage President-elect Biden's economic tools?
I don't think it was a deliberate attempt to do so, but certainly they didn't have to do it now. And actually, they limited to a degree the optionality or flexibility that the new Treasury Secretary would have. So that's what I mean by political, because a good, peaceful, smooth transition shouldn't be throwing sand into your successor's job. And I think that's what he did. So that's why I mean it had a flavor of a political action.
The unemployment crisis is yet another challenge on the path of the incoming U.S. president. The overall U.S. unemployment rate is currently 6.9%, which, while better than April's 14.7%, still means that 10 million pre-pandemic jobs are lost.
The real problem of reinvigorating industry in the United States is trying to figure out how to get small and medium-sized enterprises to restart, to go back on the track, because in fact it is the small and medium-sized industries that create most of the jobs, most of the opportunities, and have much of the opportunity for innovation, both in the environment and in a better quality of life.
Analysts say people who have been unemployed for 6 months or more are about twice as likely to drop out of the labor force as to find employment. Additionally, the longer a person is out of work, the less consumer purchasing they do, which further slows economic growth. Data shows that long-term unemployment as a share of all unemployment is growing fast across the U.S. In October, 3.6 million of the 11 million unemployed Americans had been out of work for 6 months or longer. That's a ratio that is not seen since mid-2014, when Biden was the country's vice president and the unemployment rate, like today, surpassed 6%. The continuing unemployment crisis has led economists to become increasingly pessimistic about when the country might return to pre-pandemic levels. Business and academic economists surveyed by the Wall Street Journal in April predicted that the labor market would recover by 2022. But when surveyed again in October, 55% had extended the recovery forecast to the year 2023 or later.
Time now to bring in Atifeh Paridar. She's a researcher and journalist, and she joins us now to tell us more about the state of the U.S. economy. Welcome. So this time around, you're not only going to share with us your media post, but you were also the writer of this program. So that's obviously right. You have a lot to say.
Yeah, well, I took to the social media because obviously Americans on social media, as I found out, are as divided as they are outside social media on whether Biden is the right guy for reviving the economy and salvaging the country from the pandemic. Well, there are a lot of guys who think that since Biden was the vice president of Obama and did the great job back in 2009 after the Great Recession, and Biden helped Obama to revive the economy and create jobs, so he's the man for the job. They think that he can do this. But, you know, this is a total different situation because that was something about mortgage, and that recession was not due to the pandemic. We have to see if Biden can do this. A pro-Trump account is saying that Biden supported trade of the working economy, world peace, and low unemployment rate for a guy who just not Trump. You're all pronouncing it retarded. Sorry for that last word.
No, that's okay.
Yeah, well, they're saying that things are already good. Why we have to bring another guy that we don't know if he has a plan or not? A lot of them are saying that Biden is going to let China take over the world economy. As we know, China at the moment is the second biggest economy in the world, and they are the U.S. biggest rival. So they're saying that Biden is not the man for the job.
Okay, if he gets confirmed, that is. Thank you so much for that. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Of course. Thank you. Atifeh Paridar there about the state of the U.S. economy and the social media post. All right. We couldn't cover the U.S. economy without talking about the unemployment situation. As usual, there's a disparity between the official figures and the actual number of people who are unemployed, number which is, well, it's said to be perhaps over 30 million. And that is a result of the pandemic.
The killing of George Floyd, an unarmed African-American man at the hands of a white police officer, was the start of yet another wave of nationwide anti-racism protests in the U.S. Massive rallies and mobilizations against racial discriminations brought America's ongoing struggle with racism to the fore. But the ugly face of systemic racism is not just shown in viral videos. It has also been apparent as COVID-19 affects black communities in particular.
Racial inequality is extraordinarily evident and will involve recreating some of the basis for trying to overcome the profound political, cultural, and social inequalities that characterize the United States at the present time.
Official figures show that African Americans are less likely to have health insurance. This holds true even among the employed. Black workers are 60% more likely to be uninsured than white workers. Along with the lack of coverage, black Americans have higher rates of chronic illnesses, including diabetes, high blood pressure, and obesity. All these conditions contribute to making the coronavirus pandemic all the more deadly for blacks, than for whites, whom accounts for more than 60% of the population, but only about 53% of the deaths from the virus. Higher rates of infection and death among minorities demonstrate the racial character of inequality in America. All being said, observers believe that the next president of the United States won't be able to fix the economy or save the nation from the deadly disease unless he addresses the systemic racism that divides Americans. Addressing the pandemic's health and economic effects requires acknowledging these facts and acting accordingly. Back in September, it's been estimated that the U.S. has lost $16 trillion as a result of discrimination against African Americans. A new study conducted by Citigroup shows that since the year 2000, the U.S. gross domestic product has lost that much as a result of discriminatory practices in a range of areas, including in education and access to business loans. And not acting to reverse discriminatory practices will continue to exact the cost. Citigroup estimates that the economy would see a $5 trillion boost over the next 5 years if the U.S. were to tackle key areas of discrimination against minorities.
While the U.S. President Donald Trump is pushing ahead, trying to invalidate the results of the U.S. presidential election and drawing up plans to, like, attack Iran, Americans are dying. Shouldn't he focus on the economy more? But what about the fight on the economic front? Are there enough efforts that are being applied against the devastation that the COVID-19 is causing, like unemployment and hunger? I mean, a stock market that is performing well, that's not the only barometer that the economy is actually doing well. If Trump is out and the U.S. President-elect Biden is confirmed, what guarantees are there that he will be able to fix the problem? Just throwing money at the problem is not the solution, which is actually one of his solutions. It is reported that he's going to go on a $7 trillion spending spree. Where is that money going to come from? That's all the time we have for this week's episode. On behalf of myself, Kavit Halfway, and the whole team here on Economic Divide, stay safe and see you again next time.
This is A to Z. An introduction to Islamic lifestyle. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Most Beneficent, the Most Merciful. Dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum. Peace and blessings of Allah be upon you all. This is A to Z, coming to you from IRIB English Radio, and I'm your host, Ali. This radio show is about Islamic lifestyle, and in each episode, we will be talking about a different lesson. Please stay with us till the end of today's program. Today's lesson, how to keep your faith strong. In life, we all go through seasons. Some are wonderful, some are very rough. We go through mountaintop experiences and we go through deserts. Which are you in right now? Well, chances are your answer is based on your life experiences right now. Perhaps you just received a great new job, or perhaps you are without a job. Perhaps you're having a great season with your children, or perhaps they are being very challenging. Perhaps your marriage is in a great place, or perhaps you are struggling. The less your personal life experiences and situations impact your belief, the higher level of faith you possess. Many people, they claim, and in reality, they possess faith. But faith has different levels. When you are in your comfort zone, when everything is working out perfectly fine, you know, people tend to express their faith and use the quality of their faith in their decision-making, the choices they make. But sometimes, contrary to this, if they're going through a rough patch, now the choices that they make, they're not necessarily based on their faith. And this is where many a times we all go wrong. When we're angry, for instance, do we take our faith into consideration and the commands of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and Prophet and Ahlul Bayt into consideration? Well, guess what? Most of the people who claim to be faithful, they don't. So make sure that your faith is not something which is changing because of your circumstances. If you want to possess a higher level of faith, be consistent. Welcome back, dear listeners. Today we are discussing how to keep your faith strong. And we said that people, when they're faced with challenges and turmoils and trials, this is when their faith gets tried. So if you want to strengthen your faith, make sure that it's not situational. It needs to be this constant state of your existence, constant state of your heart, a constant state of your soul, which is to be in obedience of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. If you attain that, and if I attain that, and if we attain that, rest assured that we have a higher level of faith. But let's say if our faith is trembling, it's all over the place, as soon as we get put into a challenging situation, we lose our faith and our decisions, they are contrary to what our faith dictates, this is something to be concerned about. Well, we all know the power of love. People give their lives for worldly love and material infatuations. Imagine if this love gets the right direction. It will do wonders. Look at our shuhada, the martyrs, our arafa, the mystics, how they have sacrificed everything and anything that they have. For who? Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Because they have found their true love. So one of the tips today we're going to give you is fall in love with Allah. If you fall in love with Allah, you are certainly going to be able to strengthen your iman and faith. Obedience is the second one. When we obey the commands of Allah, He increases our faith in Him. Last but not the least is worship. Worship of Allah is a gateway to establishing that bond with Allah. He doesn't need our worship and ibadat. Okay, this is to our benefit. He strengthens our belief once we worship Him. So three things: love, obedience, and worship. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at www.parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
What about you? IRIB English Radio.
please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The article you'll be hearing is headed COVID Overload. US hospitals are running out of beds for patients. The article has been written by Reed Abelson, who has been a reporter for the New York Times since 1995. She currently covers the business of healthcare with a focus on health insurance. Please stay with us for more of Reed Abelson's article. As the coronavirus pandemic surges across the United States, hospitals are facing a crisis-level shortage of beds and staff to provide adequate care for patients. In excruciating pain with lesions on her face and scalp, Tracy Fine lay for 13 hours on a gurney in an emergency room hallway. All around her, COVID-19 patients filled the beds of the hospital in Madison, Wisconsin. Her nurse was so harried that she could not remember Miss Fine's condition, and the staff was slow to bring her pain medicine or food. In a small rural hospital in Missouri, Shane Zundel's severe headache turned out to be brain abscess. His condition would typically have required an operation within a few hours, but he was forced to wait a day whilst doctors struggled to find a neurosurgeon and a bed, finally at a hospital 375 miles away in Iowa. From New Mexico to Minnesota to Florida, hospitals are teeming with record numbers of COVID-19 patients. Staff members at smaller hospitals have had to beg larger medical centers repeatedly to take just one more patient, but many of the bigger hospitals have sharply limited the transfer they will accept, their own halls and wards overflowing. In the spring, the pandemic was concentrated mainly in hard-hit regions like New York, which offered lessons to hospitals in other states anticipating the spread of the coronavirus. Despite months of planning, though, many of the nation's hospital systems are now slammed with a staggering swell of patients, no available beds, and widening shortages of nurses and doctors. On any single day, some hospitals have had to turn away transfer requests for patients needing urgent care or incoming emergencies. And rising infection rates among nurses and other frontline workers have doubled the patient load on those left standing. There is no end in sight for the nation's hospitals as the pandemic continues to hammer cities and rural areas across the United States. And public health experts warn that the holidays may speed the already fast-moving pace of infection, driving the demand for hospital beds and medical care even higher. Healthcare systems are verging on the edge of breaking point. Dr. Michael Osterholm, a member of President-elect Joe Biden's COVID-19 Advisory Council, said in a podcast this month. The public does not realize how dire the situation is, Dr. Osterholm said, and may respond only when people are dying, sitting in chairs in waiting rooms in emergency rooms for 10 hours to get a bed, and they can't find one, and then they die. When Ms. Fine went to University Hospital in Madison, Wisconsin, she found doctors there overwhelmed and distracted. They just parked me in a hallway because there was no place for me to go, said Ms. Fine, 61 years old, who was eventually found to have a severe bout of shingles that threatened her eyes. She had missed her annual checkup or a shingles vaccination because of the pandemic. Medical workers at University Hospital in Madison, Wisconsin, pleaded for help in an open letter. Without immediate change, our hospitals will be too full to treat all of those with the virus and those with other illnesses or injuries, they warned. Admitted to a makeshift room with curtains separating the beds, Ms. Fine watched the chaos around her. A nurse did not know who she was, asking if she had trouble walking or heard whooshing in her ears. She was just completely frazzled, Ms. Fine recalled. Workers at the hospital issued a plea recently, published as a two-page advertisement in the Wisconsin State Journal, asking state residents to help prevent further spread of the coronavirus. Without immediate change, our hospitals will be too full to treat all of those with the virus and those with other illnesses and other injuries, they warned. Soon, you or someone you love may need us, but we won't be able to provide the life-saving care you need, whether for COVID-19, whether for cancer, heart disease, or other urgent conditions. As healthcare providers, we are terrified of that becoming reality. University of Wisconsin Health declined to comment directly on Ms. Fine's experience, but acknowledged the strains the pandemic has imposed. While patients were sometimes boarded in emergency room even before the new coronavirus surge, occupancy is now super high, said Dr. Jeff Pothoff, the group's chief quality officer. University of Wisconsin Health is starting to do things it hasn't done before, he said, including enlisting primary care and family doctors to work in the hospital treating seriously ill patients. It works, but it's not great, he said. Hospitals in St. Louis, Missouri have been particularly hard hit in recent weeks, said Dr. Alexander Garza, the chief community health officer for SSM Health, a Catholic hospital group, who also serves as the head of the area task force on the coronavirus. Over the last month, SSM Health turned away about 50 patients that it could not immediately care for, and nurses, already one of the group's most vulnerable to infection, are adding more and more hours to their shifts. Hospitals are reassigning nurses to adult intensive care units from pediatric ones, doubling up patients in a single room, and asking nurses who typically care for two critically ill patients at a time to cover three or even more. If you're not able to dedicate as much time and resources to them, obviously they're not getting optimal care, Dr. Garza said. Consuelo Vargas, an emergency room nurse in Chicago, Illinois, says patients linger for days in emergency rooms because intensive care units are full. The nursing shortage has a cascading effect. It leads to an increase in patient falls. This leads to bed sores. This leads to delays in patient care, she said. Personnel, available beds, and protective equipment are fundamentally scarce. At a news conference held by the National Nurses United, a union, Consuelo Vargas said there was still not enough protective equipment like N95 masks, forcing her to buy her own. Some hospitals have joined in sounding the alarm bell. Supplies of testing kits, face masks and gloves are running low. The country never quite caught up from the earlier shortages, Dr. Osterholm said. We've just got going to run into a wall in terms of personal protective equipment, he said. Even if hospitals in some cities appear to have enough physical space or can quickly build new units to set up field hospitals, staff shortages offset any benefit of expansion. Beds don't take care of people, people take care of people, said Dr. Mark Harrison, the chief executive of International Healthcare, a sprawling system of hospitals and clinics based in Salt Lake City. We're out here by ourselves, said Tony Keene, chief executive of a rural hospital in Missouri with 25 beds. We don't have a larger system pumping money into us or something like that. At any given time in recent weeks, a quarter of the Intermountain nurses were out sick, quarantining or taking care of a family member felled by the coronavirus. Nursing students have been granted temporary licenses by the state to fill gaps, and the hospital system is scrambling to latch on to troubled nurses who are in high demand across many states and expensive to hire. To relieve pressure on its big hospitals, Intermountain is keeping more patients at its smaller centers, monitored virtually by specialists at the larger hospitals who consult with the local doctors via remote links. Smaller hospitals are under significant stress. We don't have intensive care units, said Tony Keene, the chief executive of Sullivan County Memorial Hospital, a rural hospital licensed for 25 beds in Milan. We don't perform surgeries or anything like that here. When we have COVID cases, it very much taxes our abilities. His tiny hospital usually has no more than half a dozen patients on a busy day, but many now treat twice that number. About a fourth of the hospital's 100 employees, including Mr. Keene himself, have come down with the virus since March. It is sometimes a daily hour struggle to make sure we have adequate staff in the hospital, he said. The hospital's nurses, who typically work 3 12-hour shifts a week, are taking as many as 5 or even 6 shifts every week. We're out here by ourselves, Mr. Keene said. We don't have a larger system pumping money into us or something like that. The hospital used federal COVID aid to invest in medical care gas lines so patients could be given oxygen. The sickest patients still must be transferred, but a larger hospital 35 miles away is awash with its own heavy volume of COVID patients and is reducing staff levels as well. Even when hospitals in the community are talking weekly, if not daily, to discuss how to handle the overall spikes in admissions, few have room to spare in areas where numbers keep climbing. Many have reduced or even stopped providing elective surgeries and procedures. We're all concerned about the surges we're seeing now, said Nancy Foster, Vice President of Quality and Patient Safety Policy for the American Hospital Association. Patients who need special medical attention normally can be sent to a nearby urban area, but many times those referral centers are full or nearly full, she said. Mr. Zondo's case was a matter of life and death. He had a debilitating headache and was not able to function at all, he said. A larger hospital nearby was inundated with patients, so his wife took him to a small hospital in rural Missouri to be seen quickly. The doctors were recognized that he had a brain abscess but could not immediately find a medical center to treat him. He was dying, his wife said. Some hospitals had beds but no available neurosurgeon. Staff members spent a full day trying to find somewhere he could get an operation. They just worked the phone until they found a solution, she said. They didn't give up. Mr. Zondel, a 48-year-old, was finally phoned to the University of Iowa Hospital and clinics, where a neurosurgeon performed an operation on him. But Iowa is also turning away patients, Dr. Howard said. Earlier in the crisis, we were being hammered by limitations in personal protective equipment. Now the problem is beds are full, he said. Dr. Dixie Harris, a clinical care specialist in Intermountain, had volunteered in New York City during the height of the pandemic last spring. Doctors are now better able to treat the virus and predict the course of the disease, she said. But they are also stretched very thin, caring for COVID patients in addition to their regular patients. Almost nobody has had a real vacation, she said. People are really tired. And readmissions, or the lingering health problems of COVID-19 long haulers, have compounded the intensified regimen for medical care. Not only are we seeing the tsunami coming in, we have the back wave coming in as well, Dr. Harris said. Some healthcare workers say they feel abandoned. Nurses have been carrying out for months and months, and this has been a problem. And we really have not gotten rescued, said Leslie McCamey, a nurse in Bismarck and a member of the National Nurses United. Leslie McCamey said, "We're working overtime, we're working several different jobs, and we're really feeling the strain of it all."
Start.
Movement.
Speed.
Live in hope.
Toward the peak.
On Youth Station.
I am a Muslim. Islam ID. Allah my Lord. His word Quran. Muhammad Prophet. Praise be upon. I am Muslim for all.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم everyone. You are with us at Youth Station from IRIB English Radio, and I'm Mehdi, your host.
Hamza Hosseini. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
I'm not going to keep on introducing you every time and do your job yourself.
When is silence accepted, huh? Wow, Mehdi bhai, not here, man. Silence is accepted here. When is silence accepted and recommended, and when it is wrong?
But has it ever happened to you that you woke up to someone, or like you're chatting and you say something and they, you get no response?
And you get no response?
Yeah, they were like probably using their own phone or something like that. What do you think about that?
Like, most of the youth do this nowadays. Like, the elders are speaking to them,
yeah,
and then their phone is like, yeah, yeah, and that's it. But
you know what that reminds me of? Not talking too much. I was listening to one of these scholars. They were saying that when Adam, peace be upon him, was out of heaven, and he was there with his children, he had a lot of children, and they were playing around and they were loud and stuff, they came to him and they're like, you know, we play, we have fun, we're loud, we make we, you know, all these games that we play. Why do you not say something? You don't say anything and you just sit in there silent. You know what he said? He said that Gabriel, he came to me and he said that if you want to go back to the place that you came from, lessen your speech.
There is a well-known saying as well that if a person does not boast, right, or backbite about anybody else, right, the amount that he will speak will be less than 30% of what he normally speaks.
That's some, I don't know, was there a survey?
That's some deep stuff, man.
Yeah, but like, how do they know 30%?
Like, yeah. The rest of it is just nonsense, right?
Mm-hmm.
We speak with society or within our friends, communities and stuff like that.
So are you saying like it's actually not bad to be quiet and just not say anything? Like, I want to find out, is there a line between when not to, like, be speaking, and when to be talkative?
Okay,
is there a line?
There is a line. Like, for example, when someone speaks up for their rights, when someone is being oppressed, right, you have to speak up.
Yeah, or someone else's rights, you know?
Yeah.
But there's a hadith that says that if there's something wrong that's happening around you, this is the gist of it, you know. If there's something wrong that's happening around you, it's upon the person who has knowledge to apply his knowledge and speak about it. You know, that's
definitely,
yeah,
that's exactly how it is.
Have you heard the saying that in the times of disrupt, be like the disruption?
Yeah.
Be like the child of a camel. What do you call a camel child?
Okay, yeah, yeah, I've heard that.
Yeah, so that no one can milk you and no one can ride you. Where does that fit in? Right? So you're talking about oppression. You're saying if there's oppression, for example, you have to speak up. But, like, oppression is a kind of disruption, isn't it? You know?
Yeah.
So should I not be like that and not say anything, you know? Like, avoid this side or that side?
But then we have the story of Hazrat Ibrahim and the little bird that came and he was bringing water to Hazrat Ibrahim as well.
What story?
Whereas they say that so there was a bird that was trying to take water to Hazrat Ibrahim alayhi salam, right?
Mm-hmm.
It was asked that, why are you taking this water to Hazrat Ibrahim? Whereas you know that this little drop of water won't be able to stop the fire. When Hazrat Ibrahim alayhi salam, he was caught in the fire and the enemies had put him into the fire,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
There was this one bird that was bringing a little bit of water within its beak.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so it was asked that, why are you taking this a few drops of water that won't even help the fire go down?
Yeah.
A little bit.
There had to be a catapult to throw him in because they couldn't even get close to the fire. That was a massive fire.
Yeah. So it was... It replied that at least I am doing my duty, that may be that it can help the Prophet, peace be upon him, and I can answer Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala on the Day of Judgment that I did my part.
Mm-hmm.
For example, if we stand up for places like Palestine, like we have the Day of Quds, which is well known worldwide, like the Day of Quds, the Rally of Quds.
What is that?
Which is on the last Friday of Ramadan.
Yeah, what do we do?
We have a rally and standing up for the oppressed of Palestine, mm-hmm. the oppression that's going on there. Yeah. And so, it was said by Imam Khomeini, rahmatullah alayh, that every person, every Muslim should stand up on and have a rally on the last Friday of the month of Ramadan, right?
And it comes back to
what our ambition there is, right? Or our goal, we can say, is that we're standing up for Palestine, even though we can't go literally or physically and go and help them, right?
Mm-hmm.
But at least we're speaking out for the oppression so other people can know about the situation as well, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then on the Day of Judgment, when we're going back, like, we're all gonna go back, man, one day, unfortunately or fortunately,
mm-hmm.
yeah, and we can at least answer back that at least we did stand up for the oppressed, we did speak out for them.
Yeah, at times being silent is being with the oppressor. So far that's all we've been mentioning, right? Like, we have to but there has to be a time that not saying something is better, isn't it? What's that? You don't say something, you're mm-hmm. quiet. Is there a place that you're supposed to be quiet?
There is, like, for example, there is when you see that your argument, right, is not reaching anywhere, right, and you should not go ahead with that argument. And just silence is the best result that you'll get.
There's a narration that says, stop for the sake of arguing. That's called jadl.
Yeah.
In Arabic. Stop doing that, even if you're right.
Because mm-hmm.
you know there's no point, you know, there's no conclusion, there's no result of whatever you're saying right now.
Yeah.
So, yeah, there's no use over there.
Because you're not going to get any results from it. Like, you're just arguing for the sake of argument, aren't you?
Yeah. Like, if you have a dogma or the other person has a dogma.
Yeah.
No.
When is it wrong?
Oh, you know, that reminds me of, do you know the scholar who wrote Mafati
al-Jannah?
Who wrote that?
Yeah, Sheikh Abbas Qummi.
Yeah, Sheikh Abbas Qummi. Do you remember the story with his father?
Oh, yeah. I remember that one.
That's what I remember of when silence is all right.
Yeah. Like, his father, he comes and he's in his room and he's writing a book. And his father says, why are you always writing these kind of books, right?
Yeah.
And he knows that it's his father, right? So he can't argue back, right? And he says that, here, you should write books like these, which are at least useful to people, right? And then Sheikh Abbas Qummi picks up the book, he's silent, right? He looks at the back and he sees that it's his own like handwritten book.
Yeah.
And then, mashallah,
he doesn't say anything.
Yeah, he doesn't say anything.
I don't know if that's how the story goes, but what I heard was a bit different.
Okay. Let's hear your part as well. Then.
Yeah, my part is this, that once his father tells Sheikh Abbas that, listen, there's a scholar there in the mosque and he's giving lectures from this book, which is amazing.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Anyway, either he was there or he was at home, but like, he said, you should be like that person. Listen to that scholar. You might learn something.
Uh-huh.
And he said, yeah, please pray for me that, you know, I'm like that. That's somewhere, you know, why he'd probably be silent, because that what he did wasn't for his own. Remember what you just said? You said, like, it's not boasting and it's not.
If it's not backbiting or boasting.
Yeah, you know. So he didn't boast himself, you know, something that he did, he kept it quiet, you know. That's actually beautiful.
Like, in history, we have a lot of examples like that. Like, for example, we look at the example of Imam Ali alayhi salam.
They say that, Imam Ali alayhi salam says that al-mu'minu warrun kareem. It means that a mu'min is a person, a believer is a person, that he's so generous that he is often seen as being tricked, but he's not actually tricked.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but he's so generous that he doesn't let people know. No, he's silent. He doesn't let people know. For example, three mates, we're standing, yeah. And one of us makes a joke about the other person, uh-huh. And
the other one stays silent.
Yeah, he realizes that they're talking about him, but he doesn't say anything, you know, to not embarrass them or something like that. Uh-huh. That's where, like silence is probably right, you know.
At that point, no one will stay silent, though. And the example you gave was nice, yeah, but in today's society, everyone wants their own little piece of the cake and reply back.
Yeah.
There's another example of Imam Ali al-Islam, when he stayed at home for the first couple of years when the Khalifas 25? Came in.
You mean
yeah.
the first couple of 25 years?
Yeah, because he saw that it wasn't of any use at that time. And
why,
then after that, he came out.
But he wasn't silent.
Talking about the importance of silence, like going out and into society and like speaking for his rights openly.
Yeah, right? That's what I'm saying. Like, he wasn't silent, wasn't he? Was he? He wrote letters to them. He actually spoke against what they did wrong, yeah. And stuff like that. So 25 years, you're actually right. It was a kind of silence, wasn't it? Like, because he said I was patient, as if there's a thorn in my eye and a bone stuck in my throat. You know, he didn't.
Yeah, exactly.
He couldn't like call out loud. So this was. Why was this? Because he didn't want disunity among the people, and actually there would be no religion left if he had risen against those people. You know, so that's exactly. That was for the betterment of the religion, right?
Betterment of the Muslim Ummah and society around him. Yeah, definitely. That's exactly. Reminds me of another example. I have a good friend here, right? He's in Qom as well. The Sayyid, right?
Yeah.
And this guy, proper nice, humble guy. So he's going around and is helping this really old man, lives like near us. And so he's like, from the bottom of his heart, this uncle comes up to him and is like, listen, yeah, kiddo, I need some help. Yeah, I need you to buy my groceries, my son's like, so and so. He had a mental problem originally, the old man did, but so my friend just, because I'm being kind, he went and helped him out. So he's going every day buying this guy, I don't know, his stuff for his house and his groceries separately. Whereas this old man didn't need it in reality. He had his sons and stuff who helped him out, but he just had that like, what do you call it, schizo or something? Yeah,
schizophrenia.
So this guy, yeah, he gets the stuff from him one day and he says, listen, I need my visa extended. Gives him his passport. And because he's in doubt of everyone, he comes outside his house and he knocks on his door. And he's like, where are you? I'm calling you. The guy was asleep and he was knocked out.
I don't get it. Whom did he give the passport?
He gave the passport to my friend, right? And
the old man
he wasn't Iranian, right? So he gave his passport to my friend and said, help me out with my visa and stuff. So this guy comes outside the door and he starts swearing his head off, right?
The old man
And so my friend comes out and he gives him his passport and says, listen, man, I can't help you. End of story. Now, if he replied, right,
and
he would have got the same reaction back and forth, and it would have carried on probably into fist fights and stuff. But because he was quiet and silent at the time, right, all the other people that lived in that area, along, and like now they know that this guy is, he's got a bit of mental problems, you know.
Yeah, and this, yeah, the other guys are, yeah, is respected
one,
now. Yeah.
It's like just one example of silence, right? How much has helped this guy?
We were talking about Imam Ali al-Islam and his patience. Have you heard the story about someone asking Imam if why doesn't he think when he's asked a question?
Why doesn't he think?
Yeah. Why doesn't he pause or think when he's asked a question? And Imam says to him, how many fingers do you have? Go snap, five.
He said, then you didn't have to
think. Why did you not think about that? He's like, because it's obvious, isn't it? It's like so visible. I know that it's five. So Imam's like, everything that people ask me, like knowledge, is just like that for me. So that's why I don't think.
MashaAllah.
That actually indicates that when you do not know something, it's all right sometimes to be silent.
Yeah, I think we need to put that into practice.
But like, also, okay, like, if you're thinking about the pants or whatever, you're silent. That's a different silence.
Exactly.
But, you know, the silence or saying that I don't know is actually better than, like, making things up and just spilling them out.
Yeah, definitely. Like, they say that one word after thinking and silence is better than 1,000 words without thinking.
Yeah.
Exactly. May Allah give us the tawfiq to like act upon this, inshallah. Because in society and
I'm going to start practicing that right now. That's why you see me a bit down.
Alright, you can start it after the show. But I think within society it's not implied as much.
Right. I think we talked a lot when it comes to silence, you know. Silence is something that's not supposed to be talked about, right? Like it's
something that's supposed to be acted upon.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, it's silence, but we talked a lot about that. Thank you for being here, man. From IRIB English Radio, with me was Hamza. We were talking about
silence.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
My love, my life, my days, my nights, my wealth, my prayers are for you. Now I know how it's like to have a precious love in my life. Now I know how it feels to finally be at peace inside. I wish that everybody knew how amazing it feels to love you. I wish that everyone could see how your love has set me free. Set me free and make me strong.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 49 meters, 7,300 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.